Wendy C. Wickwire, Ethnography and Archaeology as Ideology, The Case of the Stein River Valley. In BC Studies number 91-92, Autumn and Winter, 1991-1992. Part 1, Introduction. Throughout the world today, the environmental and social sciences have assumed a new role in resource development. Much of this work is undertaken through the burgeoning field of impact assessment, whether environmental, social, or heritage. The nature of impact assessment science is a growing topic of debate, given the conflicting interests of the environmental, native, government, and corporate interests which are involved in and often pay for this work. In this paper, I shall examine one resource conflict where impact studies have played a major role. In particular, I shall review the ethnographic and archaeological studies done as a result of the proposal to construct a road into and to log in the Stein River Valley of British Columbia. My analysis results from my own work as an ethnographer actively involved in the issue as a consultant for the Native Bands for almost 10 years. I analyze the problem, therefore, as experienced from inside the debate, but the perspective set out here is larger than simply that of one side of the debate. Increasingly, anthropology is being evaluated as a vehicle for self-critical social analysis, or deconstruction, and thus as a method of contemporary cultural critique. Written in such a spirit, this paper provides a critical survey of the social scientific research, in this case ethnography and archaeology, associated with a recent native environmental logging controversy in British Columbia. Its purpose is to show how science serves social interests. As such, the paper builds on the perspective put forward by James Clifford, The Predicament of Culture, George Marcus, and Michael Fisher, Anthropology as Cultural Critique, who argue that anthropology should be brought forcefully into line with its 20th century promises of authentically representing cultural differences and using this knowledge as a critical probe into our own ways of life and thought. Background: what is the Stein and who is its community? The Stein River Valley is located only 160 kilometers from Vancouver. It is an intact watershed measuring 1,060 square kilometers, surrounded on all sides by high ridges, which stand above sweeping forests and meandering valleys. It is an ecological whole. A major river, large, long tributary side creeks, a varied forest, high alpine meadows, glaciers, and mountain peaks. The Stein River's lower reaches cut through an old community which stretches along the west bank of the Fraser River from below Lytton to roughly 25 miles above Lytton, an area known locally as the West Side. Except for the large Earl's Court Farm and several small homesteads, the entire West Side is continuous reserve land supporting a population of a couple of hundred people. With its gravel roads often impassable in spring, gravity irrigation ditches, some of which are still in use, family fishing stations and drying racks, DIA homes, some still without electric power or telephones, the occasional use of horse and buggy, the West Side's identity is distinct. Its integrity is preserved, for one thing, by the area's dependence for access on an old motorless two-car reaction ferry which crosses the Fraser River. The ferry is greatly affected by seasonal changes in the river, which can close down vehicular access during high water. The local population walks across the sidewalk on the railway bridge when the ferry's out. Prior to the road building and logging boom of the 1960s, the Stein, like many other valleys in British Columbia, was a quiet place, where local people, mostly native, hunted, fished, trapped, and gathered cedar root, mushrooms, berries, and edible roots. By 1972, however, every other major valley in the area had been logged, and the Forest Service began to look seriously at the feasibility of logging the Stein. The proposal sparked minor resistance, which gradually grew over the years. By the mid-1980s, a Stein preservation movement emerged, comprising environmentalists, natives, hiking enthusiasts, and local residents. Before, during, and even apart from the political conflict associated with exploitation, ethnographic and archaeological information has been central to activities in the valley. Culture and development. At the heart of both pro- and anti-logging arguments has been economics, the numbers of jobs and amount of timber lost or gained, the cost of road building and timber hauling, and the potential for tourism development. But equally as important has been the cultural historical information associated with the valley. To those opposed to logging, the Stein has been regarded as a place for fishing, hunting, food gathering, and above all, a sanctuary imbued with a spiritual power that has sustained countless generations of native inhabitants. To those in favor of logging, the valley has been viewed as public crown land, suitable for a multiple-use strategy, incorporating logging and recreation, as well as some wilderness and heritage values. These two sides have used ethnographic and archaeological information to construct their arguments. In the case of British Columbia Forest Products, BCFP, archaeological work was undertaken to satisfy the conditions of Section 7 of the British Columbia Heritage Conservation Act. This section required that prior to any major development which would disturb or alter the landscape and thus endanger heritage sites, a site survey or site investigation be done to locate and evaluate heritage resources in the area and to assess the impact on these of the proposed development. The company proposing the development, in this case BCFP, was responsible for funding the study and for presenting it for review by the Heritage Conservation Branch, HCB, then the department within the Ministry of Tourism, Recreation and Culture, designated to manage the province's heritage resources. Between 1986 and 1988, the Lytton and Mount Currie Indian bands compiled their own ethnographic and archaeological reports, first in response to the BCFP report, and later as a basis for their own alternative proposal for a Stein Tribal Heritage Park. Two Vancouver-based organizations, the Institute for New Economics and the Western Canada Wilderness Committee, also participated in this heritage study. Their objectives were explicitly to challenge the logging agenda. A socio-historical analysis of past archaeological ethnographic research in the Stein reveals two distinct approaches to culture and land. The first, 1897 to 1961, was rooted in the academic and museum community and focused on culture as a study object, complete in and of itself. The second, beginning in the 1960s, focused on culture as a component of resource development. Unlike its earlier counterpart, this later phase of research was undertaken outside of the academic institution. Initially, it focused on the popular educational and recreational potential of its subject matter. By the 1970s, however, archaeological research became aligned with provincial land mapping activity, itself a component of land allocation and development planning. Beginning in 1979, archaeological and ethnographic research had begun to play a role in land and resource development through the new field of impact assessment. By 1988, archaeology and ethnography had become key players in environmental resource conflicts. Part two of this paper reviews, in chronological order, the cultural information generated prior to the period of conflict. Part three then examines the cultural research undertaken between 1985 and 1988. This is the central core of the paper, as it contains much of the primary material for this case study. The final section, Part 4, analyzes the limitations of these recent archaeological and ethnographic positions and offers suggestions for an alternative heritage review process. Part 2. Approaching Culture and Environment. The Stein and Cultural Historical Research. The anthropologist Franz Boas, 1858-1942, initiated archaeological and ethnographic research at the Stein in 1897, with financial support from Morris K. Jessup, chairman of the board of the American Museum of Natural History in New York City. Boas had designed a 5-year-long project to study and map the cultural relations between the native peoples of the North Pacific coasts of both North America and Asia. This was a period of enormous change, and Boas believed that it was both urgent and necessary to record as much information, ethnographic, linguistic, and archaeological, about the old cultures as possible before they died or became too contaminated by Western ways. The regional focus for much of the first year of the Jessup project, undertaken by Boas and a number of his associates, was British Columbia. Lytton, where Boas had spent a few days in 1888 and 1894, was highlighted as an area which might yield good results. 1. Harlan I. Smith. Archaeologist Harlan I. Smith was the first member of the Jessup team to conduct research at the Stein. During the summer of 1897, as part of a larger survey of the Lytton area, Smith studied the north and south banks of the Stein at the mouth, uncovering what he considered to be significant ancient village sites and burial places. He also hiked several miles upstream and recorded, with the assistance of his native guide Jimmy, pictograph sites along the way. In his field notes, Smith commented that at least two of the pictograph sites were places where young people went to fast and bathe during their training period. He published the results of this summer's work in a memoir of the American Museum of Natural History entitled The Archaeology of Lytton. Smith also collected as many items from these sites as he could, everything from skeletal remains to shells, pipes, bowls, and other implements, and shipped them to the American Museum of Natural History in New York City, where they were catalogued for future academic analysis and evaluated for their worth. Such collecting was considered both important and timely, possibly the last opportunity to obtain these rare pieces of exotica. 2. James A. Tate. James Tate also conducted ethnographic work at the Stein. Like Harlan Smith, he worked closely with Boas on the Jessup project, as well as on the subsequent projects, until his death in 1922. Boas first met Tate at Spence's Bridge in 1894 and was very impressed by him. He was a Shetlander who had emigrated to Canada in 1884. In just 10 years, he had not only familiarized himself with the ways of the local native people, but he had become fluent in their language and had married a woman from one of the local native bands. At Boas' suggestion, Tate began to make a written record of Tlacopamuc's life. This became a lifetime research project, leading to the publication of a major ethnography, The Thompson Indians of British Columbia, and a series of monographs on basketry, ethnobotany, and tattooing and face and body painting. For all of these, Tate interviewed Tlacopamuc's Indians throughout the interior, including Lytton and the Stein. He also collected archaeological and ethnographic artifacts at the Stein. 3. Charles Hiltou. Charles Hiltou also conducted ethnographic research in Lytton at the turn of the century. A self-trained anthropologist, he was not directly associated with Boas or the Jessup project. He did, however, assist Smith in Lytton with his archaeological survey during the summer of 1897. Independently, Hiltou conducted a series of interviews with Lytton chief Michel on the old ways of his people, which he published as an ethnography of the Tlacopamax in 1899. This work contains a number of key references to the stein, in particular to the pictograph sites which were said to occur in places where certain celebrated shamans underwent their fasts and training to gain their powers. Hiltud also explained that some of the paintings, those which were 20 or 30 feet above the ground, of which there are a number along the Stein Trail, were considered, to the Indian mind, to be particularly mysterious. 4. David Sanger. After Tate's death in 1922, formal ethnographic and archaeological activity in the vicinity of the Stein ceased until 1961, when archaeologist David Sanger conducted a site survey on the west bank of the Fraser for the National Museum of Man, Ottawa. The work was part of a larger burial site study of south-central British Columbia, initiated by Charles Borden, because of concern about the uncontrolled looting of burial sites in British Columbia's southern interior. The academic objective of the project was to add to the cultural history of the southern interior. While he was in the Lytton area, Sanger camped on the property of the Johnny family who lived adjacent to the Stein trailhead and traveled on horseback along the west side of the Fraser with Andrew Johnny Jr. Like Smith, Sanger hiked up the Stein Trail and recorded pictograph sites, as well as the petroglyph site near the mouth. He was very impressed with the west side and stressed in his final report that several seasons could be spent conducting investigations in this area, which has a potential exceeding any area of the interior known to me. The Stein as a resource issue. Popular education, recreation. During the 1960s, pictograph enthusiast John Corner of Vernon, British Columbia, visited and sketched most of the Stein pictograph sites from the mouth upriver to Earl Creek. He later published this information in a book on the pictographs of south-central British Columbia. By bringing this little-known heritage subject into the popular domain, Corner's book established rock painting as an educational recreation resource, heritage tourism in the offing. In 1972, the Forest Service under a social credit government undertook a feasibility study as a prelude to logging the Stein. It was not until 1976, however, that it officially announced that logging in the Stein would proceed. The delay was due to a two-year moratorium on logging placed on the valley by a new democratic government. In response to the logging announcement, conservation groups organized their own unofficial public meetings in Vancouver and Lytton in 1976, and a year later formed the Save the Stein Coalition. The coalition was made up of 17 non-governmental, environmental, and recreation organizations representing 45,000 members. As a result of its pressure on Forests Minister Tom Waterland, the government announced in 1978 the creation of a Stein River Public Liaison Committee, on which members of the Stein Coalition were invited to participate. Concerned about the lack of public awareness of the Stein Valley, Roger Freeman and David Thompson, members of both the Stein Coalition and the Stein Public Liaison Committee, prepared a hiking guide to the area. Published in 1979, Exploring the Stein River Valley was the culmination of 2 years of research and months of hiking through densely forested valleys and hillsides. As their main goal was to encourage more people to visit the valley, Thompson and Freeman focused mainly on trail descriptions. However, they also included historical and cultural detail, as well as a summary of the proposed logging plans. Because of this, the book became a significant catalyst for drawing the logging issue into the general public domain. These publications by Corner and Thompson Freeman marked the end of the utilization of archaeological and ethnographic information for strictly educational and recreational reasons. After 1979, with the logging agenda more clearly in view, cultural research became more political. The Stein as a Resource Issue, Allocation and Mapping. In the 1970s, land resource allocation was becoming increasingly more important, entailing a new concern to map heritage sites throughout the province. This was the objective of the archaeological research team led by James Baker during the summer of 1973. Funded by the Heritage Conservation Branch, the team carried out an archaeological site survey along the west side of the Fraser, mapping a total of 122 sites, of which 49 were on the banks of the Stein River. Toward the late 1970s, a much larger heritage mapping study of the entire Lillooet-Fraser region was undertaken by a team of researchers. In their published report, Lillooet-Fraser Heritage Resource Study, the authors noted that in Lytton, archaeology was a major heritage resource. Of 350 archaeological sites along a 150-mile stretch between Chilliwack and Texas Creek, just under half the sites found in the Lytton area were assessed to be the best preserved and the most important in the region. The report suggested that the sites at the Stein's mouth could provide a focus for the interpretation of Indian history. Stein Heritage as a Resource Issue, Development Assessment. In 1979, while the Public Liaison Committee was meeting to discuss the logging plans for the Stein, the Heritage Conservation Branch initiated a judgmental site inventory along the main Stein Valley Trail between Cottonwood Creek and the bridge near the mouth of the Stein. Its goal was to assess the significance of sites and their sensitivity to land-altering agencies associated with logging activities, and to provide heritage resource management input into BCFP's plans. Undertaken by archaeologists Mike Russo and Georgie Howe, the project consisted of a six-day survey along a 32-kilometer corridor, during which eight new sites were discovered. Four of these were pictograph sites. Russo and Howe also re-recorded all but two of the pictograph sites, which had been previously recorded by Smith and Sanger. This was the first study directly associated with the logging plans for the valley. By 1982, logging looked imminent. The regional manager of the Forest Service announced that timber from the Stein would be hauled out via the Lower Stein Valley. As well, the owners of Earl's Court Farm were notified of the intention to expropriate a right-of-way across their farm for access to the Stein Trail. With their year-and-a-half-long search for a less destructive access route ignored by what they viewed as a unilateral decision by the government, the members of the Stein Coalition withdrew from the Public Liaison Committee, following which the committee disintegrated. In February 1985, the Minister of Forests made a formal announcement that road building would begin as soon as possible in preparation for logging. By this time, however, resistance to the logging proposal had begun to build among native and environmental groups and local residents. Within months, the local residents of Lytton and Lillooet had established a Stein Action Committee, and a new group of Vancouver Stein supporters had formed a Stein Wilderness Alliance. Meanwhile, the Western Canada Wilderness Committee, the Vancouver-based environmental organization, launched an educational campaign on the Stein, which included widespread newspaper coverage, public meetings, and public debates. The boldest strategy of all, however, was a Labor Day Stein Voices for the Wilderness Festival, hosted by native and non-native groups, which attracted 500 people. By October 1985, the contract for the road construction was awarded. The Stein as a Resource Issue, Development Conflict. In November 1985, the Vancouver-based Institute for New Economics, INE, a nonprofit research institute, released a report on the Stein. Supported by the two tribal councils, the Lillooet and the Tlacopamucks, and funded by the Donner Canadian Foundation, this study, unlike the economic studies which preceded it, examined the development proposal in light of the socio-political history of an area dominated by a boom-and-bust economy. It concluded that the environmentally disruptive, one-time character of the logging proposal was not appropriate to the emerging structural needs of the local communities, needs which emphasize greater economic diversification and resource sustainability. The INE report included a brief ethnographic reconstruction, drawn mainly from the research of James Tate, of the Tlacopamax pre-contact seasonal cycle and the religious life, showing the stability of the culture over time and its dependence on wilderness. It also drew attention to several key ethnographic features of the valley, such as the use of the Stein Trail as a traditional travel and food gathering route of the Lytton and Mount Currie peoples. With its goal to counteract the logging agenda, this ethnographic study was the first undertaken explicitly in the context of development and conflict. Part 3, Development, Conflict, and the Role of Archaeology, Ethnography, 1985 to 1990. From 1985 to 1988, a number of archaeological and ethnographic reports were released, all of which were undertaken in a context of development conflict. 1985, Industry's Assessment in the Context of Conflict. During the late summer and early fall of 1985, while plans for the road were being developed, BCFP hired Ian Wilson Consultants Limited to conduct its required preliminary heritage impact assessment study along the route of the proposed Stein Hall Road. The report was released in October 1985, just as road construction crews were surveying the access road under the scrutiny of protesters and media. In his 13 days on the Stein Trail, studying the proposed right-of-way, Wilson recorded 8 new heritage sites, 3 lithic scatters, 1 cash pit site, 2 pictograph sites, 1 culturally modified tree site, and 1 historic cabin. He also re-examined the sites recorded by Russo in 1979. Of the sites he examined, Wilson assessed 4 to be in danger of impact from road construction. Of these 4, he noted that 2 would be totally destroyed. But as both were assessed to be of low heritage significance, their loss did not pose a problem. He noted that 2 other sites, pictograph panels, due to their location on flats below talus slopes across which the proposed Hall Road would be constructed, might be in danger of impact from falling rocks, but that such damage could be avoided by care, exercise during construction, including front-loading of material from the slope. On the heritage value of the Stein Trail, Wilson stated that the apparent lack of archaeological site density beyond the mouth of the river suggested to him that the area was only sporadically utilized on a subsistence basis, probably only for short periods of time. He surmised on the basis of few archaeological finds west of Earl Creek that the Stein Trail as a route from Lytton to Mount Currie was not a major travel corridor, but rather only occasionally used and was more commonly used to gain access to specific resources. An ethnographic research report by consultants Randy Bouchard and Dorothy Kennedy was appended to Wilson's archaeological report. Entitled Indian Land Use and Indian History of the Stein River Valley, this was not an impact assessment, but rather a descriptive historical summary and an inventory of native place names and food-gathering areas in the valley. Although not well integrated with Wilson's report, the ethnographic appendix did make conclusions which reinforced the archaeological findings. For one, Bouchard and Kennedy concluded that the Stein Trail was probably not used as a general travel route, but rather only sporadically as a battle route. Secondly, they concluded from their field interviews that the Stein was not used during this century for spiritual purposes, and they did not consider the issue further. 1985, Environmentalist Response. In the fall of 1985, the Stein Action Committee and the Institute for New Economics obtained funds from both the MacLean Foundation and the British Columbia Heritage Trust to undertake an independent archaeological survey of the Cottonwood Creek area. The object was to study the archaeological potential of the Cottonwood Creek area from its headwaters in the Alpine down to its confluence with the Stein. Archaeologist Mike Russo led the survey and noted in his final report, an impact assessment and inventory of heritage resources within the Upper Stein River drainage basin, southwestern British Columbia, that there was very little tangible evidence of significant cultural activity in the areas surveyed. Some months later, in January 1986, the Lytton and Mount Currie bands released their response to the BCFP Stein Heritage Impact Assessment in the form of a formal report entitled Stein River Heritage, Summary and Evaluation. Dana Lepofsky, the archaeological consultant for this report, offered the following criticisms of Wilson's report. First, she drew attention to two large and well-known Lower Valley pictograph sites, which had been recorded by Smith and Sanger, but not revisited by Wilson. Secondly, she assessed the sites for impact and concluded that four, not two sites, were in danger of impact from falling boulders. Finally, she challenged the assumption that a pictograph was a physical artifact only, suggesting instead that the definition be expanded to include the images within their environmental context. According to this definition, the Stein pictographs were clearly subject to new levels of impact. Indeed, Lepofsky suggested that with an appropriate contextual definition of a pictograph, the entire valley might be seen as a complete site insofar as the pictographs were themselves directly related to the valley, for example, as guides to good hunting areas or places of special spiritual power. Viewed as a totality, they formed a complete network of geographical and spiritual meaning. This approach implied a very different analytical perspective than that utilized by BCFP. The present author reviewed the ethnographic component of the BCFP report. She cited additional ethnographic evidence showing that the Stein Trail was used more than just sporadically for battles. Tate had noticed in his monograph, The Lillooet Indians, that the Mount Currie and Lytton people were once on friendly terms and traveled back and forth to visit one another. Such evidence provided broader cultural meaning to the environment surrounding the trail and therefore to the site of the proposed road. Citing John Corner's pictographs of the interior of British Columbia, she also drew attention to the fact that pictographs along trails are often indicative of well-traveled trails and migration routes. The Stein battles were reassessed in light of the evidence that they were possibly brief post-contact occurrences. Finally, she criticized the BCFP ethnography for its lack of attention to the spiritual character of the valley for Native cultural life. 1986-87, the issues become public and political. The heritage debate became public in January 1986, shortly after the provincial government appointed an 8-member Wilderness Advisory Committee to address the Stein and other issues. Archaeology and ethnography figured prominently at the Wilderness Advisory hearings. At the Vancouver sessions, Dana Lepofsky, archaeological consultant for the Lytton and Mount Currie Indian bands, argued that a road would seriously impact pictograph sites, while Ian Wilson, consultant for BCFP, stated that logging posed little threat to the sites. The committee evaluated both sides of the cultural argument and concluded that logging should take place to save jobs. It recommended, however, that the archaeological sites of the Lower Canyon be treated carefully and with consultation with the native groups whose heritage is at stake, and that the road not be constructed without a formal agreement between the Lytton Band and the provincial government. While the government evaluated the results of the Wilderness Advisory Committee, the native bands moved ahead on their own agenda for the valley. Drawing on the example of a native wilderness camp on the Queen Charlotte's, the bands extended an already operating wilderness program in the Stein and established a rediscovery program with its base in the heart of the valley, ironically at the site of the first block of timber later slated to be cut. They also worked jointly with the Vancouver-based Western Canada Wilderness Committee to clear a so-called heritage trail through the valley, approximately along the traditional route. As in the previous year, they hosted their annual Stein Valley Voices for the Wilderness Festival, drawing larger numbers. Both the Rediscovery Program and the Stein Festival provided outlets for the native people of Lytton and Mount Currie to make public their cultural and spiritual bond with the Stein Valley and their opposition to logging. In late 1986, the provincial government announced that after considering the Wilderness Advisory Committee's report, it would proceed with logging. In this decision, they ignored the recommendation that no road be built without the formal agreement of the Lytton Band, stating that Chief Ruby Dunstan of the Lytton Band had refused to negotiate. Chief Dunstan immediately responded that the Forests Minister had made no attempt at all to contact her. Confrontation loomed again, especially when the government signed a letter approving the BCFP logging plan. With logging controversies on Mears Island and the Queen Charlotte Islands, the Stein became the forest industry's symbolic stand against what it perceived to be the erosion of its land base. With a $200,000 grant from the British Columbia Council of Forest Industries, BCFP, and the Caribou Lumber Manufacturers Association, the industry launched its own Share the Stein public relations campaign, establishing storefront offices in Boston Bar, Lytton and Lillooet. The campaign promoted the benefits of a so-called multiple-use strategy for the valley. There was little sympathy within this movement for native land claims. In response to the Share the Stein campaign, the Western Canada Wilderness Committee organized its own series of public meetings and slide presentations in the local communities of Boston Bar, Lytton, and Lillooet. In contrast to the Share the Stein campaign, the representatives of the Western Canada Wilderness Committee endorsed the native spiritual and physical connection to the land. This triggered strong opposition from the many Share the Stein supporters and loggers present, especially at the Lillooet meeting. University of British Columbia forestry professor Les Reed addressed the differences head-on at this meeting when he questioned the role of cultural considerations in resource development. 1987-1989, Impact Assessment versus Cultural Initiative. In October 1987, the Lytton and Mount Currie bands organized a ceremonial signing of a strongly worded Stein Declaration in which they stressed that it was their prerogative to decide on the valley's future. As the direct descendants of the Aboriginal peoples who have inhabited, shared, and sustained, and been sustained by the Stein Valley for tens of thousands of years down to the present, our authority in this watershed is inescapable. We ourselves have never dismissed this obligation. We have never entered an agreement with any nation or government which would abrogate our authority and responsibility in the Stein watershed. As an assertion of living cultural claim upon the valley by peoples articulating their own continuing relationship to the area, this statement stood in sharp contrast to the static, site-specific approach of industry consultants. In February 1988, Ian Wilson released a revised edition of his 1985 Heritage Resources Inventory and Impact Assessment. Among his revisions was his recording of the two Lower Valley pictograph sites, which he had omitted from his original report. This new data, however, did not alter his original conclusions. Wilson noted that because the paintings at these sites were on a protected rock face, he anticipated no damage from falling rock. He advised, however, that care be exercised during road construction in the vicinity, for example, by the use of a front loader to ensure their safety. Like Wilson, Bouchard and Kennedy also revised the ethnographic appendix, but with no alteration to their earlier conclusions. Just a month after the release of Wilson's revised impact assessment, the Western Canada Wilderness Committee made its entry into the Stein heritage debate with the publication of its own impact assessment study of culturally modified trees in the lower and middle canyons of the valley. Undertaken by a dendrochronologist, the study applied a similar argument to trees as had already been applied to pictographs, that is, that certain trees were historical and cultural entities which would be destroyed by the logging activity. Marion Parker surveyed portions of the proposed logging road, as well as some of the proposed logging blocks. Using an increment core sampling method, he determined the ages of certain trees. He also recorded six culturally modified tree, CMT, sites, many of which, he estimated, were in use between 1839 and 1936. Parker concluded that no logging or road building should occur without a thorough investigation of the dendrochronology of the area. One of the CMTs featured in Parker's report had pictographs etched in charcoal on the open face of its scar. This very unusual archaeological discovery caught the attention of a Vancouver Sun reporter who wrote about it in an article entitled Native Art Lives on Stein Trees. In response to the public attention given to the Western Canada Wilderness Committee report, BCFP contracted Ian Wilson Consultants Limited to review it. Accordingly, Wilson, assisted by archaeologist Morley Eldridge, revisited the CMT sites and subsequently published a critique of the Western Canada Wilderness Committee's study. Wilson and Eldridge concluded that Parker had overestimated the impact of the road on CMTs. They also noted that only in a few places would the road affect culturally modified trees. Wilson and Eldridge criticized Parker's increment core methodology, where information is obtained without harming the tree, for its lack of utility for CMT research. They argued that from the standpoint of scientific value, more information can be gained from these trees by cutting them down and obtaining stem round samples than from avoiding them, even if non-destructive increment cores were to be obtained. Wilson and Eldridge also stated that the trees are better felled in any event as scientific information, particularly regarding the oldest CMTs, would in fact be lost if the trees are not cut because the trees rot and die with age. In the same study, Wilson made an official record for the Resources Management Branch charcoal pictograph described in Parker's report, noting that he had some doubts, however, concerning both its age and authenticity. Regarding impact from road construction, he noted that because of its location, 0.5 kilometers east of the proposed Hall Road, no adverse impacts will occur as a result of the proposed road. Wilson also made an official record of a pictograph cave in the valley which he located by helicopter, high above the trail on the north side of the river, several kilometers above the cable crossing. His conclusion about this site was that no impacts would occur, as it was well removed from the proposed logging road and does not appear to be even in sight of the nearest proposed logging block. Wilson explained that he had used a newspaper photo and report, Province, 29th of February 1987, to find the cave. In early May 1988, the Stein Task Force, headed by Patrick Armstrong, distributed an 8-page tabloid entitled Share the Stein to 150,000 households, including provincial and federal politicians in Vancouver and elsewhere. The paper, which favored a multi-use strategy for the valley, also featured highlights from interviews with BCFP's archaeological and ethnographic consultants, Ian Wilson and Dorothy Kennedy. In an article entitled Forest Companies Protect Native Culture, it was stated that the BCFP Impact Assessment Study was the most extensive archaeological and ethnographic study ever conducted for a proposed logging road. Wilson claimed that the whole road was designed and engineered around the archaeological sites, and he praised BCFP for taking such an interest in native heritage. Kennedy similarly praised the company, adding that BCFP had gone beyond the call of duty in their efforts to locate and protect cultural heritage. In the late spring of 1988, Lytton and Mount Currie chiefs Ruby Dunstan and Leonard Andrew, in meetings with Forests Minister Dave Parker, argued that they needed time to conduct their own studies on the tourism, economic, and heritage values in the valley. They informed Parker that the Nalaxum Nation Development Corporation had received funds from the Native Economic Development Fund for a Stein study. Both chiefs stressed to the Forest Ministry that no development of the Stein should occur until their study had been completed. After bitter negotiations, Dave Parker finally agreed to this request and allowed the native people the summer to compile their reports. Although the main thrust of this native project was economic, focusing on tourism, Some of the funds were allotted to ethnographic and archaeological study because these values were now central to a different form of economic development than had hitherto been contemplated. In conjunction with a heritage study and impact assessment already undertaken by the native bands, the proposal for a Stein Cultural Interpretive Center for the Valley turned the whole issue of impact assessment on its head. The native heritage study focused on two areas, the significance of the valley's pictographs and an oral history of the Stein community. For the pictograph study, the bands imported archaeologist Brian Molyneux from England. He examined the sites and publicly reported that they were absolutely astounding. In the 15 to 20 years that I've spent studying rock art, when I say this site is world-class, I'm not kidding. Such a statement from an outside expert stood in sharp contrast to the earlier statements made to the press by local archaeologist Mike Russo that the Stein archaeological sites were not particularly unique, and by Ian Wilson that a road through the valley would not have an impact on the sites. The band reports were completed in October 1988 and presented to Forests Minister Dave Parker. To date, there has been no response from the Forests Ministry. While the Nlakapaksam project was in progress during the summer of 1988, BCFP initiated another heritage impact assessment study of the valley along the proposed right-of-way to the west of the cable crossing. For this work, archaeologists Ian Wilson and Morley Eldridge were contracted to resurvey the final right-of-way alignment to ensure that known sites were avoided, and also to identify and evaluate any additional sites within the right-of-way. The overall conclusions and recommendations of this new report remained essentially the same as those of the earlier BCFP studies, even after a more expanded study of the CMTs in the valley. Of 217 CMTs which Wilson and Eldridge identified, they noted that the building of the proposed haul road would have a minimal effect on the CMTs, as only 34 of these, or 15% of the total, would actually be felled. They reiterated their position that the scientific significance of these trees could be mitigated by taking stem round samples from each. In September 1988, the New Zealand-based multinational corporation Fletcher Challenge officially took over British Columbia Forest Products. Soon after, it announced that there would be a one-year-long moratorium on any development in the Stein. The moratorium ended in 1990, and as yet, no decisions have been made on future plans for the valley. Part 4, Ethnography, Archaeology as Ideology. This paper has examined the heritage research undertaken in the context of one environmental controversy. It is not an isolated case, however. With the scale of mega-developments in the province, logging, highway construction, dam construction, mining, etc., during the last two decades, heritage impact assessment has become a significant research area. For many archaeologists, this form of contract work has become the major source of employment. Although they are generally regarded as independent and neutral, this is not so. In the case of the Stein, the BCFP consultants examined the archaeological sites along the proposed haul road and concluded that few were in danger of impact, and that where there was potential impact, this could be successfully mitigated. Meanwhile, the consultants for the native bands examined the same sites and concluded that some sites, especially pictographs, would be affected. The BCFP researchers studied the Stein Trail and concluded that it was used only sporadically for battling, while the band consultants examined the trail and concluded that it was a well-used trail for a variety of peaceful cultural purposes. The Western Canada Wilderness Committee examined the heritage and culturally modified trees along the haul road and concluded that many were in danger of damage from road building. The BCFP archaeologists looked at the same trees and concluded that many trees should actually be cut down for scientific purposes. Although arguably objective, in fact, the conclusions reached by both sides support the interests of those sides. Context as content. the limits of artifactual archaeology. Archaeological impact assessment studies are initiated in response to proposed development projects which will disturb or alter the landscape, potentially endangering archaeological sites. Formerly required by the Heritage Conservation Branch, HCB, and now required by the Archaeology Branch, AB, under the Ministry of Tourism and Ministry responsible for culture, such studies are paid for by the company proposing the development. On completion, they are evaluated by the AB. It was this requirement which led to the BCFP Heritage Site Inventory and evaluation along the 34-kilometer Stein Corridor, the area proposed for the Hall Road. There are serious problems with this heritage review process, however. First, it defines the landscape narrowly as an inventory of sites within a development zone. Such an approach not only separates individual sites from their larger context, but also it further reduces these to the physical remains which were left at specific places sometime in the past. The handling of pictographs and CMTs illustrates the problem well. Following the guidelines of the HCB, the industry archaeologists concluded that damage due to road construction would be minimal. In contrast, the native band's consultant defined a pictograph more broadly and concluded that the impact of a road would be serious. In the case of pictographs, ethnographic interpretation can be utilized effectively in the archaeological review process. For example, ethnographic interpretation of the religious rite and ritual associated with these pictograph sites supports the view that everything is connected. The aural quality of the place, the special rock formations, the bend in the river at a particular point, the mythology of the place, all these come together to make the place suitable for painting. Thus, in assessing the impact of logging on rock art, ethnography has a very important practical function in archaeological interpretation. Unfortunately, however, ethnography's potential to inform archaeology is rarely realized due to the restrictions placed on it by the AB. This branch is charged with managing archaeological, not ethnographic, sites and resources. Consequently, it excludes ethnographic interpretation as a factor in the impact assessment, except as an aid to locating archaeological sites or as providing a setting for the archaeological data. The limits of this narrowly defined function of ethnography in archaeological impact assessment study are evident in the BCFP Stein Heritage Studies. On the one hand, the archaeologist recorded the sites and assessed the impact on these from road building and logging, while on the other, the ethnographers undertook a separate and unrelated inventory of native place names and food gathering areas, with no reference whatsoever to the impact on these from logging. Other than to provide a loose setting for the archaeological inventory, there is no apparent reason for including an ethnographic component in this report. The approach to CMTs in the Stein is similarly limited. One group rationalized the cutting of CMTs in the name of science, while another rationalized their preservation on the basis of their place in the larger forest ecosystem, from which they might derive some heritage value. In the name of neutrality and fact-finding, one treats culture as past, its remains as dead and isolated artifacts. The other treats culture, though changed, as present and ongoing, its meaning still evident in many sites in their living context. Context as content, the potential of ethnography. A major weakness of the inventory approach to heritage assessment is its reliance upon tangible physical remains, to the exclusion of all else. In areas where there are habitation sites and burial sites, there will naturally be tangible remains to be assessed. In a valley like the Stein, however, which was utilized over a wide territory for hunting, fishing, spiritual, and travel purposes, tangible remains may be few and often difficult to uncover. Low archaeological visibility does not necessarily mean low archaeological significance. Because major decisions are being made on the basis of low site density, and therefore low heritage value, the criteria for defining significance need rethinking. The BCFP archaeological assessment of the Stein Trail from Lytton to Mount Currie illustrates this point well. It concluded that due to sparse archaeological finds along the trail beyond the lower valley, there was probably only sporadic use of the area. However, such a conclusion was drawn from the presence of tangible remains to the exclusion of all else. Ethnographic analysis, for example, might yield a very different assessment of the heritage value of the area. The ethnographic record, both archival and present day, of the Nalaka Pamix people, which is unusually full, explains why there are few tangible remains in the Stein Valley. It also provides a rationale for the valley's heritage significance, regardless of the number of artifacts listed in a government inventory. According to the early record, most of which was compiled by Tate, the large village sites, such as those at the Stein's Mouth and along the west side, functioned as semi-permanent bases, which during the salmon season and coldest winter months were occupied by most of the people. During the rest of the year, however, most of the young and able were in distant areas hunting and gathering, often for many months at a time. With its close proximity to large winter village sites, the Stein provided easy trails and access to deer, goat, bear, and other animals, fish, mushrooms, and other edible plants. The relationship of the contemporary communities to the valley corroborates this. All of the native families on the west side of the Fraser have hunted, fished, and gathered in the Stein. Many pinpoint the Cottonwood Creek area in the Central Valley as a favorite hunting and fishing area. Many of the west side men trapped along the side creeks of the Stein. This corroborates common sense understanding. Prior to contact, native peoples traveled long distances on foot with great speed. Their gear, knives, containers, clothing, etc., was important to them, so they would rarely have left it behind for later archaeologists to pick up. Even the more recent Stein trappers left little tangible evidence of their activities of just 40 years ago. According to several battle stories recorded by Tate, the Lytton and Mount Currie people traveled along the usual route up Stein Creek in about 2.5 days. Among those who have hiked along difficult trails, the Stein traverse to Mount Currie is considered an easy route. Prior to the construction of the Caribou Road along the Fraser River, the Stein Trail would clearly have offered an easier alternative to the coast than the Fraser Canyon, where scaffolding was required to maneuver along certain places. Ethnographic study of the religious life of the Nalaka Pamix also explains both the significance of places like the Stein for spiritual training and why there would be few artifacts deposited at these sites. As James Tate's detailed accounts show, traditional Nalaka Pamix religion was one without a lot of paraphernalia. Painted images of their religious experiences are among the few tangible remains which have survived in situ. Notes made by Tate, Smith, and Hiltoot about these painting sites reveal that they were used for spiritual purposes. Artifactual evidence, therefore, is a small piece in the puzzle. Archaeologist David Sanger, who conducted research at the Stein in 1961, noted the spiritual quality of the valley. Clearly, to my Thompson friends, the Stein was more than a beautiful valley, a place for roots and berries, a place to hunt deer and mountain goat. It was sacred. It embodied a religion far older than Christianity, one that preached the oneness of humans and the spirits that surround us. For these reasons, it is inappropriate to assess the heritage value of the Stein and places like it according to criteria which do not apply. The presence of artifactual remains where there would have been few in the first place. That burial and habitation sites are found at the mouth but not at the headwaters does not necessarily mean that the mouth was utilized while the headwaters were not. Both may have been well utilized, but in different ways. Finally, the most obvious problem with relying upon the presence of physical artifacts alone to assess heritage value is that of those few objects which were at one time deposited along the trail for religious or other purposes, many have since been removed by collectors. Extensive artifact collection by professionals, local natives, hikers, and pot hunters has taken place in the Stein and elsewhere in the Lytton area for over a century. Such collecting was one of the main activities of late 19th century and early 20th century anthropologists and archaeologists. Indeed, many of the surface remains in the area were removed and placed in museums as early as 1897 by Harlan Smith and James Tate. Countless others have been lost to private collectors and pot hunters. Consequently, a survey of the Stein Trail prior to the era of collecting would probably have yielded significantly more tangible evidence of occupation than the surveys of 1979 or 1985. Today, mainly pictographs on large rock faces and boulders remain in place, probably because they are too large to remove. Some paintings, which were made on smaller stones in the Stein, were collected, and at least one of these survives today at the Kamloops Museum. To evaluate the heritage value of an area, therefore, on the basis of tangible remains, when most of those tangible remains have been removed, is simply self-defeating. In light of such collecting, the intangible, rather than the tangible, remains are again the more reliable indicators of heritage value. Conclusion: toward a relevant archaeology and ethnography. An ideological choice clearly underlies the positions taken by the two parties involved in this work. For the one, protection of a living culture was key. Although changed, culture was viewed as something present and ongoing, its meaning still evident in the many sites in their living context. For the other, making an inventory of the remnants of a dead and dying culture was all that was necessary to fulfill the objectives of the formal guidelines of the Heritage Conservation Branch. As the industry ethnographer who interviewed only the most elderly members of the Stein community explained, "If it weren't for the proposed development of the valley, much of this priceless information would have been lost forever. It would have died with the passing of the last generation of tradition bearers." Such a static viewpoint is rooted in the so-called salvage ethnography, typical of the late 19th century anthropology of Franz Boas. While the BCFP ethnographic field study was being done in Lytton during the fall of 1985 and later in 1988, the native community was actively asserting its sovereignty over the valley in the form of an official land claim, Stein festivals, and public declarations. And yet, the BCFP ethnographic reports produced during this period declined to consider this living, vital community voice in its use and occupation study. This approach, which focuses on a static past to the point of failing to recognize the present in the field situation, is simply unacceptable in contemporary anthropology. In their book, Anthropology as Cultural Critique, 1986, George Marcus and Michael Fisher see anthropology as changing primarily because the kind of field sites anthropologists have traditionally sought can no longer be found or even imagined without dissonance. They argue for expanded relevance in anthropology so that its practitioners recognize the full historical and political implications of its projects. Some argue that the discipline can never be neutral and detached, and must therefore redefine itself as the struggle for the creation of culture against collective and dehumanizing forces. This paper has identified some of the problems associated with archaeological and ethnographic research, which is undertaken in the context of an environmental cultural preservation conflict. Because the conclusions and recommendations of such research are often used to determine a community's future, it is important that these problems are well understood. A major problem, as outlined above, lies with the AB site-specific inventory approach. What is clearly needed is a move away from a piecemeal listing of sites to a focus on the larger historical context, that is, on meaning, as opposed to inventories. Such an approach would incorporate ethnography as an integral part of the archaeological impact assessment study, and also as a methodology for assessing the cultural impact of the proposed development on the communities which will be affected by it. In addition to the problems inherent in the inventory, artifactual approach of the AAB is the structure of the funding process. Currently, the company proposing the development independently selects and finances a qualified consultant. Some of the archaeological and ethnographic consultants who do such work are well known in the larger industrial and government community, having worked for these companies for a number of years. This financial bond between the consultant and the company leads to problems, however, as those who depend upon such work become influenced by the goals of their clients. A review of the contracts awarded over the past decade reveals a pattern of company favoritism. Some companies select the same consultant repeatedly to do their work for them because they know he or she will provide them with what they want. The AAB defends this structure on the basis of its evaluation process, which requires that all contracts be submitted to it for final review, and if assessed as unsatisfactory, turned back for further work. It has limited influence with large industrial companies, many of which have strong political allies within provincial government. Indeed, many of its clients are government agencies themselves. Moreover, were the AAB to use legal means to enforce a company to do further work, it could only push so far, and then in the end, it would probably lose legally as meeting the specific standards under the present law. Ultimately, however, we need to go much further if we are to leave behind the mode of archaeology anthropology as colonial facilitator. We need to take native equality and self-determination for more than mere slogans. When we do, the entire colonizing process, AB, facilitates, would give way to a larger scale political settlement, allowing native bands throughout the province to have a legitimate voice in determining the future of areas such as the Stein Valley. Until this occurs, anthropologists have a responsibility to identify and to criticize ideological and Eurocentric social scientific research, whether presented in the form of an impact assessment or in court as expert testimony. In the meantime, as an interim arrangement only, efforts must be made to remove both the consultants and the AB from their industrial clients. One way to do this is to create an independent body, perhaps a committee, comprising a carefully balanced number of individuals representing as many of the interests involved as possible. For the Stein, such a committee might include natives, environmentalists, representatives from Fletcher Challenge, archaeologists, those who work independently of contract archaeology, and anthropologists, again, who are removed from the contract impact assessment process. This committee would be responsible for deciding on the scope of heritage study required and for determining the amount of funding necessary to cover it. The party proposing the development would disburse funds directly to the AB, which would be responsible for administering them. Such an arrangement would help to liberate the contract archaeologist, both to consider a broader range of perspectives and to make more independent conclusions and recommendations without jeopardizing his or her future contracts. It could also help to transform the function of the AAB to act not just as a mediator between the developer and the archaeological resource, but as a protector of cultural resources. Such incremental, let alone more fundamental, changes are still, it seems, some time away. In the meantime, until the native community is given its rightful position and voice in such forums, social scientists still have a crucial but critical role to play.